Welcome to the Fan Experience Experience with Darren and Mark and a special guest.
Welcome everyone to the Fan Experience Experience podcast series. Each podcast will explore a different element of the fan experience and fan engagement. Some will look at the matchday experience while others will enjoy broader themes. But every podcast will deliver value to anyone listening in football or indeed any other spectator sport. Whether it's general advice you need or ways to help you start a conversation with your colleagues, we reckon a regular dose of the fan experience will make a big difference. So join me, Mark.
And me, Darren, as we explore ways of improving the experience on match days, making clubs more sustainable and relying a little less on winning to keep fans engaged.
And if you want to find out more about what we do, the projects we're involved in, and the countries in which we're working, please check out www.fanexperienceco.com, and there's plenty there. A little earlier, I said football or indeed any other spectator sport. We're very excited today because we're leaving football behind and we're embracing rugby league. And we're doing that with one of the legends of the game, someone whose voice you recognise from the BBC, summariser. He has his own marketing business now, a man of a Maori background, and I'd like to say now my haere ki, our podcast, to Robbie Hunter-Paul.
Oh, kia ora, Mark. Kia ora, Darren. You didn't do too bad, actually, Mark. I'm really proud of you.
Well, listen, you know me, I struggle with English, but I can do foreign languages.
Oh, my haere ki. Yeah, I love it.
There you go. It went pretty good as a start. I mean, you know, obviously Darren brought up in the Black Country and I'm brought up in County Durham. So, you know, we speak our own language anyway, don't we?
I don't understand a word of these podcasts anyway. So it's not going to make a difference.
I'll speak slowly so people can understand my accent.
Well, at some point in the future, we're having Pedro Malabia from La Liga come onto the podcast as well. So we may attempt some of that in Spanish. But for now, let's just focus on it. Robbie, you and I met probably more than 10 years ago at the home of rugby league at the George's Hotel in Huddersfield, where the sport was founded. So that was a pretty momentous occasion. And of course, and this is what we always laughed about back then, you know, an absolute legend of the sport, and legend not just for being a brilliant footballer, but being, you know, one of the loveliest people anyone could ever wish to meet. But it was the fact that, you know, had you been even a minor, you know, discarded left back from the Sunderland team of the mid-80s, you know, I'd have got really excited about that. But it was wonderful because I was able to relate to you because you weren't a footballer. So rather than being too excited and shy, not knowing what to say, I was actually able to speak to you and ask you about what it was like to do that. Do you remember that day?
I certainly do. I think it was a very different dynamic, probably. Because you've set me up pretty well there, and I thank you very much. I'm very honoured to be introduced like that. But the reality was, I was coming cap in hand. I needed information from you. I was the person who was at university trying to learn the ins and outs of the fan experience and sports marketing and the commercial side of sport and every element of it. And you held the key to that understanding, that learning. We were introduced to each other through a mutual friend, Nadia Granada, who was the one of the heads of, I think he was doing sponsorship and sport at the University of Huddersfield, in which I was studying. And it was him that put us together, said, well, you've got to meet Mark, and Mark is currently doing X, Y, Z, and I come along cap in hand. So, yeah. The energy was very different, you know. It wasn't you going to meet a sporting personality. It was me coming to meet someone who was an expert in the industry.
But it was fantastic because, you know, obviously Darren being based in Nottingham at the moment, I'm based here in Bradford. And back in Robbie's early days as a Bradford Bulls player, when we looked out of our window here in Wyke, which is probably a 2-mile walk from Oddsall, all you would see would be those black, amber and yellow tops. I think I might get the colours wrong there.
Red, amber and black.
Red, amber and black. That's it. That's all we saw, you know, on Sunday afternoons, usually around 1:30, 2 o'clock. You'd just see hundreds and hundreds of people walking down there. And a big reason for that was you. And we wanted to get this out of the way quite soon because it was One of the themes we want to talk about in this podcast is that I'm in rugby league country. I've enjoyed watching the sport. I go to games. The producer and I attended the double header to kick off the current Super League season. Back at Rhinos, and we saw the Toronto Wolfpack, and it was a fantastic day. But one thing that always strikes us about rugby league is that there's a kind of affinity between the players and the fans, that they're closer to each other. And I know that one of the first things you did when you got to Bradford was to sit in the Burger King and just meet people. Is that true? I mean, to start,
Look, my first day in Bradford was quite interesting because I was getting a lot of stares, and it was the end of summer, and I'm very green, you know. It's my first day out of New Zealand, really. I've got a young family with me, and I'm walking through the town centre. This is my first day, and everyone's staring at me. And the first thing I thought was, geez, I like the rugby here. They didn't even see me play, and they're all looking at me. And what it was, though, in very New Zealand style, me and my partner at the time and our child, we're all walking around barefooted. Now, New Zealand, we do that. We walk in the middle of a city centre barefooted, but it's just not done in England. And that was something that I had to get up to speed to know I wasn't in the same place. The Burger King story sort of comes maybe a year or two later, at the advent of the Bull Mania, when the club really embraced the match day experience and focused all of their energies in and around building an audience. One of the things that they knew how to do, because there was a gentleman by the name of Peter Deakin who headed up the Bulls marketing concept, that fan experience drive. And he understood that targeting mums and young children was a way of growing your audience base. When he looked across the and this is no surprise to you guys because you guys have been dealing with it for the last 20 years, you looked across the audience of rugby league, it was an aging, gender specific old men, whippets and black caps audience, and he knew to grow the club he needed to engage with that younger family audience. So one of his master strokes that he used to say, you know, which he used to really champion, was actually getting a kid himself and building a lot of marketing momentum around them. And that kid happened to be me. Luckily, it was me, because the club changed from Bradford Northern to Bradford Bulls in one off season in 95. And the Bradford Northern team that I was a part of originally, because I came over as a Bradford Northern player, they all started getting cut one by one. Players after player, and by the end of it, by the end of that 95 centenary season, that final season, there was only three players left on the original team. And I don't know exactly if he had anything to play a part in it, or it was the astuteness of the then CEO and head coach. So a lot of people forget that the head coach at the time, Brian Smith, was also had the title of CEO, and he worked hand in hand with Peter Deakin in putting together the marketing and business strategy of the club at the time. And they come up with an idea to make me the captain, the poster boy. And so literally, so getting back to the Burger King story and bringing to life poster boy, what he did was he created like 5,000 posters with me on the front of them. And we took over Burger King one day, and I sat there. One of those days, so the Bulls had been to Wembley, and so they had a quite a decent following. And I sat there with a number of other teammates, but I sat there the entire day signing posters for what, as I can remember, was the entire day. And I got to admit, for a professional athlete, I certainly did get through a lot of Burger King that day.
So anyway, when it does come to writing the second set of your memoirs, I think Barefoot in Bradford is an obvious title, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. I got up to speed pretty quickly. I didn't, though. It took me about a year to figure out. I had to have a few of the older players take me under their wing and just slap me around a couple of times just to get me pointed in the right direction.
What was the reaction of the fans when you were in Burger King?
Oh, awesome. Just awesome. Because, you know, it was family after family after family. And, look, I was, 18, 19? I was a kid myself. So you just have boundless amounts of energy. You turn as an experienced player and you become old and crabby and, you know, you grunt. But I'll tell you this. There's a reason why I stayed there all day. My father is one of those people that have left sort of real, real strong footprints in the sands of my life. And one of the real pertinent things that stayed with me, he pulled me aside one day and he said, "Do you remember when I used to take you to Carlaw Park and we used to go watch Great Britain play the New Zealand Kiwis international rugby?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Remember after the game, you'd jump over the fence and you'd run up to your heroes and you'd get their autographs?" And I said, "Yeah, Dad." And I said, "Do you remember how you'd come back to the car or come back to the bus we were traveling on and you'd have that autograph and you couldn't stop staring at that autograph, and then you get home and you get your album out and you put that autograph?" And I will say this to this day, I've still got that album. I've got Mark Graham's, Wally Lewis's and Ellery Hanley's autographs and Gary Schofield's as well, who were my favourite British players. Do you remember how they made you feel?" And I said, "Yeah, of course, Dad. You know, those are my fondest memories as a kid." And he said, "Well, now put yourself in the place of those kids out there. So I don't care if you have to catch a bus or catch a taxi home and you're in Workington, you stand there and you sign every kid's autograph."
Yeah.
And to this day, I do that.
You're talking, you know, obviously talking about, you know, a great family experience and a great role model in your dad. But it seems that there's lots of Robbies in rugby league. There is a sense that they haven't really left the communities. You know, a lot of young kids in football get their first contract and it's almost as if they, I don't know, just spirited away from their communities into the kind of the rarefied air of the football club. I think what you see, you know, across here and over the border in Lancashire, you see a lot of players that don't seem to have left the community behind. And I think that's probably, I mean, there are other elements with rugby league that are different from football. In particular, I think it's the recognition of a good game above whether one team wins or loses. I mean, obviously still there's fanatical support for teams. Everybody wants them to win, but there's a kind of a recognition that if you're beaten by a better side, you know, that's something to be, well, not necessarily cherished, but at least to be respected. Is that true? Am I seeing that the right way?
Yeah, look. One of the unique things about rugby league, it's one of the things you nailed early on was that it looks like they haven't left their communities. Well, we haven't. We're still living in our communities. It's a working class sport, and the boys predominantly grow up in those same communities that it's well supported in, and then we'll go on to play for those clubs or associated, connected communities in and around the areas in which they grow up in. So. It's, you know, you look into those terraces, it's not a fan. It's a lot of the time, it's your family members or it's guys you grew up with or it's their family members that they, you know, that they grew up with. So you're still very connected. There's another element as well, internally from a professional point of view, there's a lot of self-policing that goes on as professional rugby players. Now, you can't escape on the training pitch. This is a contact sport.
Yeah.
So the amount of full impact collision that's going on a daily basis, purely and simply for muscle memory and to make sure that you try and stay as safe as possible. I mean, if you can picture that scenario of two people that have never played rugby before, one gets a ball and runs at the other at the hardest he can, and the other one has to try and stop him. Both of them are going to end up in a mess because they don't know how to protect themselves. The one, the runner, doesn't know how to protect himself by getting his arms up, and two, the defender doesn't know how to protect himself by putting his head in the right position. So we spend hours upon hours sort of learning those small, intricate skills. So muscle memory takes over. We don't have to think about getting our head in the right position. It naturally, automatically gets out of the way and the shoulder and the contact's nice and clean. When you have that amount of opportunity to smash someone, and someone puts a head above the parapet and doesn't toe the line and doesn't play their part as a part of the brand,
yeah,
you got many opportunities to iron them out. For success to happen, you need to have everyone singing from the same hymn sheet. And there's a very, culturally, a very flat, very northern, I would suggest. So I've lived in other parts of the country, and it's a very northern approach to living. It's, you've got to be black and white, and you've got to do right by other people. So I think culturally, that's also a part of the reason why everyone's still quite connected. No one gets above themselves. And if you're not above themselves, then you're not above anyone else. And it's also internally, it's kind of reinforced into the players as well, from the clubs themselves, that it's a business. And the business is about putting backsides on seats. The business is about being a good person.
Robbie, in the work we do, especially with football, we talk to clubs a lot about getting their players more involved, because for all the reasons that we've talked about already in terms of them being heroes and the influence that can have on a young fan. But from the player's perspective, do you think players could do more? And I'm probably thinking in transferring some of this through to the stuff we do in football. Do you think there's an obligation for players to do a little bit more to help the fan experience?
In my experience, yes. When I've worked with commercial bodies before, from a sponsorship point of view, what you guys are saying yourselves, that it's known throughout the industry. People love working with rugby players, be it either co. Rugby players just seem to be a little more down to earth, and just in comparison to other athletes, will go above and beyond to engage with audiences, to put themselves in what can be considered an uncomfortable situation.
I think that, Robbie, one story that stuck out for me, you introduced me to Jamie Peacock a few years ago at an event.
I apologize for that?
Yes.
Wholeheartedly. I'm so sorry.
And
he's been the same since.
he was saying that, and I can't remember the distance, whether it was a half marathon or a marathon, but he said he felt so blessed and so fortunate in the career that he had, in the sport that he did, to be able to do the thing he loved. And on Christmas morning, he would run, and I can't remember if it was either a marathon or a half marathon. It was a kind of a penitence, you know, for being lucky enough when so many other people aren't so lucky. Now, Kevin Sinfield's another one of those. And you have plenty of your friends at Bradford Bulls and other clubs who do that. There's almost a kind of an institutional humility among rugby league players. And of course there are going to be ones that aren't like that. So we're not generalizing.
They're very few and far between, though. I mean, this thing that I talk about self-policing, that's quite, you know, look, I've been in teams before where you've had people, you know, and I'm not going to mention his name, but the most decorated player in the game, and culture, and he wasn't the right culture fit for the Bradford Bulls, and he didn't last the season. And it's not about airs and graces. And with anything, look, when it comes to team sports, and it's all about synergy. If you're an individual sport, it's about being the best athlete and individual that you can. But when it comes to team sport, it's about synergy. You don't have to be the best 11 or the best 13 or the best 15 on the field. What you have to be is the best group of players that can complement one another. And that can only happen when everyone likes each other. That can only happen when everyone's willing to make sacrifice for each other. And people really, in my experience, will only make sacrifice for one another if they like the person, if they like the other people around them. And that's when you get legacy success. That's when you get a legacy of success. And you're right. It is, it's institutionalized. The sport is culturally honest. Mm-hmm. And that reverberates beyond the field into the club rooms and clubhouses. And it also goes into, there's an important element that we probably haven't spoken about here, and that is player agents. And now, as a post-career as a professional rugby league player, I then became a sports administrator. And the probably the single most influential person in professional athletes' lives become their agents. These are the people that are that have, they become the confidants of the people on their ear, the people yeah. whispering the things into the ears. And the agents play a massive part in the culture output of individuals in clubs. And I think from what I've heard, I don't know, because I'm not in this sport as a professional athlete, I what I've heard is athletes, the agents are a big problem as opposed to a solution in yeah. football and how the individual athlete think. Because, you know, if the athlete themselves think, I've always got a get out plan, I've always got a plan B, I can go and play my trade, apply my trade in another country, like yeah. you know, and make equally as much money, if not more, mm-hmm. then the contract in which they sign becomes soulless. Now, a benefit, and you know, it's very different to rugby league because the moving parts aren't the same. There's not 50 professional, well-paying sporting bodies in rugby league. There's two. Mm-hmm. There's the UK or the European competitions, and there's Australia, and that's it.
Yeah.
And so your choices are finite. So I think you end up you do end up feeling a lot more blessed, yeah. feeling a lot, you know, blessed that you're getting the opportunity to apply your trade in something that you're extremely passionate about and that you love. And I think that brings with it a humility as well. So, you know, to try and compare it, it's not really comparable. And equally, the you know, only in Australia, down under, our athletes, A-list celebrities. In this country, rugby league celebrities, definitely. I mean, is there one? Is there a rugby league celebrity? I think the last one we had was Martin O'Fire, and that was in the 80s.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the reality of our sport, and that helps to, you know, to not get yourself above your station, so to speak.
Robbie, on that subject, and I went to a Rhinos game last season where, and it was a real eye-opener for me, in that as fans were walking into the stadium, there was, and I think if I remember rightly, Mark, his name was Rob, but a really senior guy in the club was standing there literally welcoming people by their name, which was for me a real eye-opener because I hadn't seen anything quite at that level before, certainly not in a, I think the crowd that night was 15,000-16,000, so it was quite incredible. And there was conversation going on, there was, you know, questions about family and all that sort of stuff, and it just felt completely different to football, you know, which I was used to. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on that, if you think there is that real sort of affinity between the fans and the clubs that you don't see everywhere else.
It's hard for me to talk upon other sports when I've been so embedded in rugby league for so long. I can talk about what I do know as opposed to what I don't know. What you'll find with a lot of Super League clubs and rugby league clubs full stop, that the people that work with them are the people that stood on the terraces when they were kids. And this has become their dream job. And they love absolutely every day of it. It's not easy. Doesn't make it easy, but it makes them embedded into the sport. You know, it makes them completely embedded into the club as well.
We're talking about Rob Oates here. You know that Darren mentioned Rob, who's
right.
I think he's the operations director at Leeds Rhino. But you know, Rob described it as a dream job. You know, when he joined, he's always been a Rhinos fan. I think he's been there for something like 17 years. You're absolutely right. That's exactly the type of person you're speaking to. He just oozes love for the club.
I know, Rob. Yeah, and I was guessing you were talking about Rob when you mentioned it, Darren. Yeah, and you know, he's a perfect example. I'd say this as well. So Rob played a bit of rugby in his time as well. He's not too bad. You know, even for an old fella, he gets out there every now and again and plays some touch rugby and that. He can move pretty well. He looks after himself. So I'll give him that. He probably always fancied himself as a, you know, probably still asking him his question. I could get out there.
Well, there's someone else that that we love very much at Leeds Rhinos, and that's Sean Jones. And Sean's been there a long time too. It's
yes.
the responsibility of virtually everything that's not related to the playing side, yeah?
Sean always looks after me. So I'm part of the Super League Selection Committee for the Man of Steel Award, the Steve Prescott Man of Steel, which is Rugby League's out-and-out Player of the Year.
Yep.
And I go to a lot of the West Yorkshire games, whenever I am selected to go watch Leeds Rhinos play, it's always get a hold of Sean and make sure that I get some hospitality tickets and looked after. And, you know, they also know that I'll sing and dance for me supper as well, so they've got no problem there.
Well, I think the thing with Sean was, I think, you know, really focused on the fan experience element, on not just basing everything on how well the team would do, but actually trying to continually improve the experience. And when we first worked in Super League, and you're going back a good 9-10 years now, we did feel that there was a kind of complacency when it came to things like, you know, compromising or doing something different with the experience to attract a new audience. You talked about families and young kids when you first came to Bradford, and we did kind of experience a little bit of resistance in the early days, you know, to the ideas of having family stands and having, you know, family pages on websites and ideas like that. I mean, I see over the years obviously that has changed a lot, and
these
ideas have been embraced. There was some resistance to start with, and Sean probably single-handedly led that kind of revolution in the way that you know, certainly Leeds Rhinos, but other clubs that follow Leeds Rhinos are now going about the way they engage with supporters.
Yeah, look, you know, it's an age-old argument with rugby league. Leeds Rhinos did it. They definitely did it. They focused on their community development. They focused on, you know, bringing buses of schools in. And that was the model that people should have taken notice from. Before them, the Bradford Bulls did it. And what we've seen from that is, I think Warrington is starting to do it. You know, they're taking a very fan approach to, especially their social media income. And if you go around the stadium full stop, they've got a lot of fan zones, pre-built areas with a lot of that type of approach to it. So, and we've seen their audiences grow. It's a lesson. It's a lesson for all other Super League clubs and any other sporting organisation that wants to go well. Listen to you guys.
Yeah, Darren, you were going to bring in an example there, weren't you?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I've seen both sides of that. I mean, on the negative side, and we've seen this a lot, Mark, where clubs will get to a certain position and then maybe trade off some of the fan experience elements that are bringing people to the stadium in favour of signing an extra player or putting a little bit more money in wages and almost in search of that next win or that next promotion or a playoff place will just really suddenly drop the fan element of things quite quickly. So we've seen that. But on the other side, and the example I was going to bring up was the Canadian Premier League that's just had their first full season. And from what I understand, they actually started on the basis of let's get fan experience right, and then worry about how good the teams are and who's playing for them afterwards. And it was just that if you get that bit right, then you fill the stadiums in the first place.
And the only way you can do that is by having joined up thinking. And that's therein lies the problem. If everyone's just trying to survive or everyone's just looking after their own area, it needs either to be owned by a single body that makes all the decisions for the collective and everyone plays a part in that collective, or it means that the majority have to get together and make those tough decisions and approach it with a fan experience growth determination.
Yeah. It's one of the things I always think is quite interesting, because obviously all the clubs are competing on the pitch in whatever sport, but very few clubs are competing for fans. I mean, the fans will, you know, generally made their choice on who they're going to support at a much younger age. Mm-hmm. So I always find it's quite interesting, and we're trying to do things about this, but trying to get clubs to share ideas and help each other, because off the field that joined up thinking is perfectly possible.
Time for the roundup.
Thanks, Cameron, once again for that beautiful voiceover. It's time for the roundup. And the story that we wanted to share with you today concerns Leeds Rhinos player Stevie Ward. He's teamed up with At Rugby Leeds and At Inspire North UK, a mental health and housing organisation, to raise awareness of domestic abuse during the current pandemic. This is another example of Rugby League taking its community responsibilities seriously, and we really do think the sport tackles the tough stuff, which incidentally is the title of another Super League campaign.
So we want to take our hats off to the work the sport does on raising mental health awareness and providing great service with its partners. And you can check out Stevie's post at @ste_ward. So I want to thank you, Darren. I want to thank you, Robbie. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next time.
And don't forget to check out our new website at fanexperienceco.com. The Fan Experience was recorded live. See you next time.